From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, is there a regional awakening to the threat posed by ISIS? Free Syrian Voices speaks out for activists held by both sides in Syria.
These individuals continue to be in our hearts, that we have not forgotten them and the important role that they have played and hopefully will one day continue to play in Syria.
Human rights groups keep North Korea on the defensive. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has called for a UN resolution mandating an international coalition to intervene in Libya. Speaking today on French radio, the Egyptian leader said there is no other choice, taking into account the call by the Libyan people and government for the world to act to restore security and stability. His comments came after Egypt conducted a second round of airstrikes Monday aimed at Islamic State targets inside Libya, following the release of a video Sunday showing the mass beheadings of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians. Some analysts say this has thrust Egypt into the role of a key Western ally against the radical Islamists. Zach Gold of the Tel Aviv-based Institute for National Security Studies says the raids, the first announced Egyptian military action in Libya, are an important new factor. Gold said Mr. Sisi has emerged as a key ally in the fight against the IS group. Cairo has been fighting its own war on terrorism in the Sinai Peninsula, where an Islamist insurgency has killed scores of security officials. Egyptian officials have blamed the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. David Ferris, a senior political science professor at Chicago's Roosevelt University, maintains close contact with Egyptian bloggers. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Egypt and Jordan, which attacked IS targets in Syria following the execution of one of its pilots last month, represent a regional awakening to the threat posed by ISIS.
The historical pattern has been that these jihadi groups have attacked Western targets, nightclubs and hotels and targets in the West. This is not the first time that they've attacked targets within the Arab world, but I think it's the first time that the reality of this violence is really coming home to some of the governments in the region. In most cases, they've been content to kind of sit back and let the United States and its allies take control of the military situation. And over the past couple of years, I think it's become clear that the U.S. is not going to be riding to the rescue here. So when they killed these 21 Coptic Christians, I think it hammered home to the Egyptian government that a solution to this problem, particularly in Libya, is going to have to be sort of devised and led by local Arab governments on the ground in the region, and that they're not going to wait for the West or for the U.S. to take action here. They're doing it themselves.
Does President el-Sisi strike you as one who is going to take a pretty tough stance against terrorism both at home and abroad?
Absolutely. I mean, the very legitimacy of the Sisi regime is founded on this idea of being against sort of global jihadism. I think this is partially a reaction to a very real strategic problem in Egypt, particularly in the Sinai and on the western borders there in Libya, and that is the presence of these militant radicalized Islamic movements that have now affiliated themselves with ISIS or the Islamic State. It's also a strategic maneuver within Egypt, though, which is to say that Sisi and his allies deposed Mohamed Morsi, and they want to convince the global public that the Islamic State and the Muslim Brotherhood are the same thing. So there's a strategic military goal here, which is to reduce the threat posed to Egypt by some of these militants. But I think there's also a sort of domestic political goal also, which is to reinforce in the public's mind and in the mind of the international global public that the threat from the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic State is the exact same thing.
David, the Coptic Christians in Egypt, some 18% of the population, have been often targets of Muslim rage in the past. Were you surprised at the outrage and unity that Egypt seems to have expressed on behalf of the Coptic Christians in the wake of these mass beheadings?
No, I'm not surprised. You know, I mean, in international politics, we have this concept of the rally around the flag effect. So while there may be significant differences within Egypt between the Coptic Christian community and the majority Muslim community, when you have an attack like this, a really gruesome and brutal attack, it's not surprising that Egyptians would rally around the Coptic Christian community under these circumstances and express their support for them, despite the differences they maybe have about exactly what the position of that community within Egypt is. The Coptic Christians in Egypt are nationalists. You know, they believe in the Egyptian project. They're part of the Egyptian project, despite having experienced many attacks, particularly on churches in the past decade or so. I think most mainstream Egyptians and most mainstream Muslims regard the Coptic Christians as an integral part of the Egyptian people and the Egyptian state and the Egyptian nation.
Barris says the threat to Egypt and Jordan posed by the Islamic State is very real. He says the IS message will resonate within the societies of both countries, and that's why they are taking this threat very seriously. Political scientist Mustafa Kamel Asaid of Cairo University says the Libyan strikes by Egypt will probably raise the stature of President Sisi, both at home and in the West, and could lead to an easing of sanctions blocking U.S. military aid to Cairo. Free Syrian Voices, a coalition of non-governmental organizations, has announced a new campaign, Hearts in Our Hands. It is focused on the release of peaceful Syrian activists held by both the Syrian government and rebel forces. Lama Faki is a Syrian researcher with one of the NGOs involved, Human Rights Watch.
The idea is really just to remind people and encourage them to speak up on behalf of individuals that are detained in Syria for their peaceful activism and humanitarian work. There are key actors, of course, that have greater leverage with the Syrian government and armed groups in the country who we are trying to target. But really, we do want to send a message to the detainees and to their families that these individuals continue to be in our hearts, that we have not forgotten them and the important role that they have played and hopefully will one day continue to play in Syria.
How many people do you think are involved? How many people are detained?
We have profiled dozens of individuals in our campaign, the Free Syrian Voices campaign, but we know that they represent really thousands of individuals that are being held by government and non-state armed groups inside the country. These individuals have been subject to enforced disappearance, to arbitrary detention, unfair trials, torture and detention, and we know that many of them now are also being subject to trials before counterterrorism courts, where they are not afforded basic due process rights, the right to an attorney, the right to an appeal. We are very concerned that these individuals, while outside of the sort of limelight when it comes to discussions about Syria, continue to suffer from extreme rights abuse.
Could you tell us some of the individuals you are targeting?
Yes, absolutely. So we do know that nearly 1 year ago, the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling on the parties to the conflict to stop arbitrarily detaining, torturing, and enforcibly disappearing individuals. Despite that, we know that the government and armed groups have failed to take steps to remedy their unlawful practices, and the Security Council has not acted to impose a second resolution or to impose any kind of penalties on the parties for their failure to comply. Key to this, of course, are the Russian and Chinese governments and their position on the Security Council, which they have used to protect the Syrian government and to continue to allow them to conduct these abuses. We are really urging the Russian and Chinese governments to reexamine their position and to allow the Council to go further in penalizing the Syrian government in its noncompliance.
You say that this is both sides involved, the government as well as the rebels.
Absolutely. We know of many rights activists that have been subject to arbitrary arrest, disappearance, and torture by rebel groups inside the country. One of them is Rezan Zeytune and other colleagues of the Duma IV. They were disappeared in December of last year, not 2014, but 2013. And we continue to not have any information about their fate or their whereabouts. There are others that have been held in Raqqa by extremist Islamist groups like ISIS. And, of course, the thousands that we know who are continuing to be held by the Syrian government.
Lama Faki, a Syrian researcher with Human Rights Watch, speaking with us from Beirut. A rights group says government and opposition forces in South Sudan continue to recruit child soldiers, despite promises they would stop. Human Rights Watch says some of the boys are as young as 13. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Estimates of child soldiers in South Sudan range from the hundreds to the thousands. Human Rights Watch says recruiting child soldiers is a war crime when those children are younger than 15. It calls on both sides to issue clear orders barring recruitment of all children under 18. HRW researcher Sky Wheeler works in South Sudan.
We know for sure that both sides have recruited and used many, many children in this conflict, and we're very worried to see that this practice is continuing now in the town of Malakal.
Government forces are in control in Malakal, in Upper Nile State.
What our research has shown is that over the Christmas period and in early January especially, there was a spike in recruitment in Malakal, and that included people who were underage children, including kids as young as 13. We spoke to many mothers whose kids had willingly gone off to join these forces, other kids who had been taken by force from Malakal town, but in several cases from right outside of the UN base.
Wheeler says about 20,000 civilians are still seeking refuge at that base.
We spoke to one mum who went over across the river to the barracks on the other side there and met with her kid and tried to persuade him to come home, and he said he wouldn't come home. And another mother who went over to try and get her kid back saw him actually being taken away on a boat together with lots of other children in an army boat.
The Human Rights Watch researcher says she spoke to a number of former child soldiers who were recruited to fight last year.
I spoke to one young guy recently. Last year he was 16 when he went to school one morning and was picked up together with dozens of other children, thrown in the back of a truck, driven for a day, and then forced to fight the next day for the first time in his life. I mean, these are quite extraordinary stories. I spoke to a couple of kids who have said that they were persuaded to join the opposition forces from the POC, the Protection of Civilians site in Bentiu, for example. Members of the opposition would enter the base, start talking with the kids, and persuade them to go and fight with them.
Wheeler says child soldier recruitment is widespread in the country. South Sudan's 2008 Child Act forbids the use of child soldiers. It sets a minimum age of 18 for either conscription or for voluntarily joining armed groups.
This conflict has really taken us back, many, many steps backwards in that process. The SDLA established a whole mechanism with officers whose job was to make sure that there were no children in any of the barracks. And actually, South Sudan, although it did still have child soldiers, had made quite considerable steps towards having a child-free army.
Another problem is that many schools have been taken over by armed groups. Wheeler says that's despite both sides agreeing last year that they would not do so, as well as recommitting themselves to not using child soldiers. The South Sudan government calls the Human Rights Watch report nonsense, saying it does not recruit child soldiers. It says HRW is using old reports and that its army has many recruits and does not need children. The opposition says since it signed an agreement last May not to recruit child soldiers, it has abided by that agreement. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A nonprofit organization's conference on North Korea's human rights record is drawing sharp criticism from Pyongyang, which is threatening to strongly respond to what it calls provocations by hostile forces. Today's conference in Washington is part of a broader plan by human rights organizations to increase pressure on Pyongyang to dismantle its repressive system of political prisons. VOA's Brian Patton reports from Seoul.
While efforts have stalled in the United Nations to prosecute North Korea's leaders for crimes against humanity in the International Criminal Court, the issue is not fading away. Phil Robertson with the independent organization Human Rights Watch says they are planning a number of ways to publicly shame Pyongyang over its human rights violations, even if North Korea's allies on the UN Security Council block any punitive action.
And of course, that may be the case because, of course, China and Russia are still there. They still have veto authority. Then we may have to search for an ad hoc international accountability mechanism.
International pressure has been intensifying on Pyongyang since the release of a UN report last year documenting a network of political prisons in North Korea and atrocities that include murder, enslavement, and torture. While the UN Security Council has not voted to prosecute North Korea, it did vote last December to put the issue on its agenda. Human rights advocates say this procedural vote was a major victory because once the issue is on the Security Council's agenda, it can be brought up again at any time. This week, the Washington think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, is holding a public conference on human rights in North Korea. Jong Il-hun, North Korea's ambassador to the United Nations, on Monday objected to the continued international focus on the human rights situation in his country. He denied any allegations of abuse and insisted that Pyongyang's offer to attend the conference was rejected by Washington, even though the event is open to the public.
We will strongly respond to the end to any of the slightest provocation by the hostile forces, such as the one in the conference convened by the United States. We will continue to develop and strengthen our people-centered socialist system that firmly guarantees the protection and promotion of human rights of our people.
But human rights organizations and the United Nations are not backing down. In March, the UN Human Rights Council will meet in Geneva and hold a session on North Korea. Also this year, the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights will open an office based in Seoul to focus on the human rights situation in the nuclear-armed communist North Korea. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
The Philippines is one of the world's leading producers of geothermal energy. Located atop the Pacific Ocean's so-called Ring of Fire, the country has used volcanic heat to produce electricity for decades. Now there is a new project underway to use this renewable resource to power an entire island. Jason Strother has details from Mindoro.
Montelago Village lies on the edge of Mindoro's Lake Nohan. It is connected to the island's power grid, but just barely. Community leader Ricky Fetisnan says stable electricity is a problem here.
This is a remote village. We have power lines coming here, but if there's a storm, the power goes out. Blackouts are common here.
For Montelago's 1,900 residents, the solution to their energy needs could literally be right below them. In the surrounding volcano-formed hills, engineers are in the early stages of harnessing Mindoro's underground heat. Fidel Correa of the firm Emerging Power says this test well will show how much energy can be produced here.
We were shooting for 40 megawatts to supply the whole of Mindoro Island with electric power from geothermal energy.
Emerging Power says geothermal produced energy could cut the cost of electricity in half for Mindoro's residents. In Manila and many other parts of the Philippines, an increasing number of brown and blackouts are expected during the upcoming hottest months, symptoms of an energy crunch that continues amid a fast-growing economy. Analysts like Benjamin Diacno at the University of the Philippines School of Economics say that is because new energy infrastructure has been neglected.
We need to build something like 600 megawatt every year for the next 15 years to meet our energy requirements.
Diacno says more geothermal investment can provide the Philippines and other countries above active volcanic zones with a cleaner and longer-lasting energy source. Jason Strother for VOA News, Mindoro.
A U.S. federal judge in Texas has issued a ruling that temporarily blocks President Barack Obama's executive order on immigration. District Judge Andrew Hannon announced the ruling Monday in favor of 26 states, including Texas, that filed a lawsuit seeking to permanently stop Mr. Obama's order. The president announced in November that he was protecting as many as 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation. The states had argued that the president had exceeded his constitutional authority. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On February 17, 1801, presidential candidate Thomas Jefferson won the support of a majority of lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives, becoming the third president of the United States. The House vote was made necessary due to an electoral tie between Jefferson and Aaron Burr. In 1929, English actress Patricia Routledge was born. She's best known for her role as Hyacinth Bucket, or is it Bouquet, in the British sitcom Keeping Up Appearances. In 1947, the Voice of America began its first broadcast to the Soviet Union. The initial Russian-language transmission spoke of giving listeners a picture of life in America. Millions tuned in to hear VOA music host Willis Conover and his Jazz Hour. In 1968, American officials reported an all-time high weekly rate of U.S. casualties in the Vietnam War, 543 killed in action and 2,547 wounded. These losses were the result of the communist Tet Offensive. In 1969, Golda Meir was sworn in as Israel's first female prime minister. She was called the Iron Lady of Israeli politics and often portrayed as the strong-willed grandmother of the Jewish people. On this day in 1972, the German-built Volkswagen Beetle surpassed the Ford Model T as the most produced car in history up to that time. In 1979, China invaded its Soviet-backed neighbor Vietnam, following the alleged mistreatment of Vietnam's Chinese minority, a territorial dispute, and Vietnam's invasion of Cambodia that toppled the China-backed Khmer Rouge regime. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Terrorist groups need a steady influx of money in order to carry out their deadly agendas. So it makes sense to prevent terrorists from raising funds and using the assets they already possess. This is particularly true of ISIL. ISIL primarily supports itself through criminal activity, including robbing banks and receiving ransoms for kidnapped victims, and extorting from individuals and businesses and raiding villages and towns. It also sells oil stolen from oil fields under its control and raises funds externally from donations. ISIL receives some money from outside donors, but that pales in comparison to their self-funding through criminal and terrorist activities. Today, ISIL controls more territory than al-Qaeda ever has, which means it has access to money and resources on an unprecedented scale. These funds are the lifeblood of its campaign of brutality, said Special Envoy Amos Hochstein. Deputy Assistant Secretary for Terrorist Financing Jennifer Fowler said, last year ISIL may have earned as much as several million dollars per week, or $100 million in total, from the sale of oil and oil products to local smugglers, who in turn sell them to regional actors, notably the Assad regime. The international coalition has taken numerous steps to trim ISIL's profits. First, they are shutting the terrorists out of the global financial network by preventing banks in ISIL-controlled territory from conducting transactions through the domestic or international financial system. To choke off the amount of oil ISIL can bring to market, coalition airstrikes are targeting ISIL-held oil fields and refineries. Also, Turkish and Kurdish authorities are focused on seizing oil that makes it out of ISIL-held territory. The United States is also working with its partners to adopt a no-concessions policy with respect to ransom payments for kidnapping. And we are working with partners in the Gulf to disrupt the flow of donations to all terrorist groups. In the future, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Fowler, we will disrupt the movement of supplies and oil to and from ISIL-controlled territory, prevent unregulated financial companies from providing support to ISIL, target the financial activities of foreign terrorist fighters going to Iraq and Syria, and work with our partners to develop a common approach to countering ISIL's financial activities. Just like any commercial enterprise whose income is less than its expenses, ISIL's financial strength will diminish unless it is able to find alternative sources of revenue or take additional territory, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Fowler. The international coalition is working diligently toward this goal.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.